This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Three facts about yesterday's Supreme Court session will tell you just how important an occasion it was. It was the first time since Watergate that the justices interrupted their summer break for work. Arguments lasted an extremely unusual 4 hours. One is normal. And for just the third time ever, the court released same-day audio. At issue, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, which is probably better known as the McCain-Feingold Campaign Reform Law. Yesterday's argument centered on the role of money in politics on one hand and free speech on the other. Designed to limit what proponents describe as the corrupting influence of big contributions, McCain-Feingold bans what's known as soft money and bans so-called issue advertising in the weeks running up to an election. Later in this program, satirist Al Franken joins us, but first the Constitution and campaign finance reform. If you have questions about yesterday's arguments, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. In a few minutes, we'll discuss how McCain-Feingold has actually worked in the 10 months since it's been a law. But first, a look back at yesterday's arguments. And joining us here in Studio 3A is Linda Greenhouse, Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times. And it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Neil.
I guess another way of gauging how important this occasion was by who was there. This was an amazing collection of people.
Well, we had eight lawyers arguing, representing 12 different parties who were debating 13 propositions from this 61-page statute that most people, even election law experts, would find impossible to read through. They were arguing over the merits of a district court opinion that was more than 1,600 pages that came down last May, and this whole thing is on a very fast track. The law was passed in the spring of 2002 and signed 2002, signed quite reluctantly by President Bush. And it raises a whole welter of questions. As you said, most of them concern the First Amendment, but we had a little bit of federalism thrown in and a bit of sort of practical on-the-ground politics thrown in the mix, and it was really quite a scene.
Well, at different points, you also had a whole bunch of these lawyers arguing both sides of the question, but it was hard to figure out who was for and who was against because it was an earlier court ruling. But the other thing that was involved is you had some very strange bedfellows here, including the National Rifle Association and the ACLU.
Yes, well, the ACLU, takes a quite absolutist view of the First Amendment, and that was their basic beef with the law, although on the other side, not arguing yesterday, but filing a brief on the other side, were some former officials of the ACLU who think the ACLU is flat wrong on this and that campaign finance regulation should be upheld. There were a number of strange bedfellows. The Chamber of Commerce was on the same side as the AFL-CIO, both opposing the law. There were something like originally 84 plaintiffs who challenged this law on its face, that is to say, before it took effect. And it was a very broad spectrum of American society, special interest groups, big business, you name it.
And the law's chief defender was Theodore Olson, the Solicitor General, whose ideological allies were all on the other side.
Well, that's right. Of course, his job as Solicitor General is to defend the constitutionality of an act of Congress that's under challenge. The government defended, and then Seth Waxman, who was Ted Olson's immediate predecessor as Solicitor General in the Clinton administration, was in there also representing Senators McCain, Feingold, and the other congressional sponsors who intervened to defend the law, and they had status as parties.
Well, the unusual same-day release of audio gives us a chance to listen in to some of these arguments. And first up, let's listen to Ken Starr, the famous former independent prosecutor, one of the lawyers arguing against the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, which he, by the way, calls BICRA, and which he describes as an impediment to the nation's political life.
The upshot is not only a federal intrusion into state and local activity at the grassroots level, but a significant diminution in speech and associational activity by parties, activity that lies at the very core of the First Amendment. BICRA's practical effect is to shift resources and power away from political parties, which have long been a source of stability for the nation, and in the direction of First Amendment protected, but at times ideologically razor-sharp interest groups.
And that the former independent prosecutor, Linda Greenhouse, does that pretty well summarize the center of those who oppose the campaign finance reform law?
Yeah, that's their policy argument. And Ken Starr has been sort of on the stump, op-eds in the Wall Street Journal and so on, making the case that this law will undermine the party structure, weaken parties because it disables the parties from raising from collecting these big unregulated checks known as soft money, and that it will shift the ability to influence electoral activity in the country to these destabilizing, unregulated special interest groups. That's his basic policy position.
As we mentioned, Solicitor Ted Olson was arguing the principal case on the other side for the proponents of the law in favor of McCain-Feingold, in other words. And here's an exchange that he has with Justice Antonin Scalia.
For a century, with the overwhelming support of the public, Congress has struggled to curb the corrupting influence of corporate, union, and large unregulated contributions in federal elections. Time and time again, this court has agreed that achievement of that goal is critical to avoid erosion of public confidence in representative government to a disastrous extent. But concentrated wealth is nothing if not creative. As this court has observed, the history of campaign finance reform has been a cycle of legislation followed by the invention and exploitation of loopholes, followed by more legislation to cut off the most egregious evasions and circumventions.
General Olson, is every problem soluble?
Well, this court hasn't found every problem to be solvable.
If, for example, the executive should make a compelling case that it is really impossible to eradicate crime if we continue with this silly procedure of having warrants for searches of houses, we wouldn't entertain the argument that, you know, this is the only way to achieve this result.
Justice Scalia there finishing up. And Linda Greenhouse, you wrote in the New York Times this morning that the justices showed an almost anthropological interest in the inner workings of politics. Is that what you were talking about right there? Is that an example?
Well, I think this was an example of Scalia showboating a little bit. You know, we know where he's coming from on this, and his view of the First Amendment is rather absolute in this area. And campaign finance regulation is unconstitutional. And he was... He managed throughout these 4 hours to eat up an awful lot of time reiterating that position in various kind of sarcastic ways, and I didn't think too much light was shed in any of those exchanges, frankly.
Well, let's talk about one of the other judges. As you mentioned, one of the key ones, Chief Justice William Rehnquist, was regarded going into this case as a swing vote in a court that is very closely divided on these issues. You write that he seemed fairly skeptical of the law, and let's listen to this tape excerpt in which he refers to a previous decision he made on campaign finance, or he contributed to, and here he appears to be reversing himself. Let's listen.
I voted in the majority, but it seemed to me since then that's the whole purpose of the First Amendment, is to allow people who perhaps don't have much in the way of public opinion try to change public opinion.
Now, explain that one for us.
Okay, what he was talking about there was a 1990 decision, a majority opinion, which he joined, that upheld the right of a state, in that case the state of Michigan, to require corporations to contribute to politics only through, not from their general treasuries, but through what they call segregated funds, PACs, political action committees, to regulate corporate speech. Rehnquist joined that opinion. That's really a long-standing basis of federal campaign finance regulation that's incorporated very much into the new law in terms of an issue we haven't gotten into, but the televised issue advertising part of the law. So it was assumed, because he joined that opinion, that that was his view, that this was okay. And there was really a lot of surprise from the the election bar in the room when he seemed to be disavowing his vote in that 1990 case.
And that leaves, as you and other observers have noted, seems to leave Sandra Day O'Connor in the position of being the deciding vote in this.
As usual, as in so many cases, as in the Michigan case last year, and yep, it seems to be in her hands.
Now, again, we were focusing on the two issues, the soft money contributions on the one hand, and as you mentioned, the issue advertising on the other. Those aren't the only two issues by any stretch of imagination, but those are the two biggest issues, and it's certainly possible the court could come down on different sides on each?
That's possible. I think going in, a lot of people assume that the soft money ban was on firmer ground than the issue advertising regulation. Coming out of the argument, I'm not sure. I think both are pretty vulnerable. One issue in the case, however, is disclosure requirements, so that speakers or entities that take out these kinds of issue ads can't hide behind some, you know, committee for better government or something. They have to disclose who they are, who their funders are, you know, what they paid, and so on. And that was kind of only glancingly referred to in the court yesterday, but no justice seemed to be challenging its constitutionality. And it seems to me if the other provisions of the law are struck down and you're left really with an option of requiring disclosure as a way of importing transparency into campaign finance, that could be a very significant straw in the wind from the argument yesterday that disclosure regulations are probably going to be upheld.
We have an email question, and this is from Adrian Rothschild in Aspers, Pennsylvania. Please explain why corporations should have the right of free speech. Why isn't freedom of speech limited to individuals?
Well, this goes pretty far back in the court's doctrine, and as came out last year when the court was considering the Nike free speech case in a kind of very heated advertising context, certainly not... Not all analysts of the First Amendment agree that corporate speech should be on the same level as individual speech. But I think what the framework here is, we're talking about political speech. Corporations, when they're engaging in commercial speech, do have a lesser First Amendment right. But this is political speech, and I think it's fairly settled ground that whether you're a corporation or an individual, you do have a right to participate in politics.
After this extremely unusual four-hour session, as you mentioned, this is all on the fast track for court review, what happens next? The justices meet to decide how they're going to parse this out?
They meet in a closed-door conference tomorrow to take a straw vote in the case. The public won't know the outcome of that, but on the basis of that, somebody's going to get the job of drafting an opinion that will speak for the court. The way this works is that if the Chief Justice is in the majority, he makes the assignment, and certainly if he's in the majority, he would give himself the assignment. If he's in dissent, then the senior associate justice in dissent, and that would typically in this case be John Paul Stevens, would make the assignment, and presumably he would take it. Now, the last big campaign finance case, Buckley against Vallejo in 1976, produced an opinion of more than 100 pages that was not signed. It was a group effort. So there won't necessarily be an author on this. But anyway, then they'll start drafting and circulating, and whatever gets five votes becomes the rule of this case. And I know they want to issue an opinion as soon as possible. This is supposed to be expedited. Campaign season 2004 is in full swing. But given how divided they seem to be, you know, who knows how quickly they can turn this around.
Well, Linda Greenhouse, thanks very much for helping explain it to us. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Linda Greenhouse is the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. She was with us here in Studio 3A. We're talking about campaign finance reform and the court's unusual session yesterday. And we're going to take more of your calls when we come back from a break. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're going to focus in the next part of the program on what the actual effect of McCain-Feingold has been since it's been a law. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We'll be right back. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're discussing campaign finance reform, BCRA, better known as the McCain-Feingold Reform Act. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join our discussion, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. As we mentioned, the McCain-Feingold Act has been in effect for 10 months now, long enough to give us an indication of how the law has and has not changed the way that money is used in politics. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Michael Malbin. He's the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance Institute, a nonpartisan think tank here in Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
What's changed since McCain-Feingold became law?
In the few months since it has been law, political professionals are not sure what the law is going to be after the courts have finished. There's been a lot of consultation with lawyers. So I think we need to cast a longer look. But the law's main effect was not to make a huge dramatic impact, or the main purpose was not to shake up politics in a radical way. It was to reintroduce contribution limits. And people are reacting to that.
And how are various parties adapting, for example, special interest groups?
Okay. The first thing the law was supposed to do was to say that members of Congress, elected officials, couldn't go out and ask for $100,000 or $500,000 or $1 million checks. The parties have done a pretty decent job at trying to adapt by raising contributions within the limits.
So-called hard money.
Hard money. And in fact, this year's hard money for the Republicans equals past hard plus soft combined. And for the Democrats, who had a harder time getting going, their hard money is more than it had been in the past and has gone a long way toward making up the gap. So the first thing to say is that parties seem to be adapting. It's not going to be instantaneous, but there will be factors.
Now, does this mean that they're raising money in smaller amounts, that
Absolutely.
These are smaller contributions?
They're raising money in smaller amounts. They're limited. They used to be able to raise easily $500,000 and $1 million. Well, it's never easy to raise that
no,
much money.
No, it never is.
But they could raise their money in six-figure amounts fairly readily, and now they cannot.
Now, what about some of the other people involved, the special interest groups, for example, represented yesterday, I guess, by the ideological strange bedfellows of the ACLU
sure.
and the National Rifle Association?
And when you were talking earlier with Linda Greenhouse, they were primarily affected by the issue ad provisions. Those provisions basically said you couldn't spend corporate or labor money, but you could go out and raise money through your political action committee and to run TV ads very late in a campaign. Those groups are trying to adapt. They don't know whether this will be upheld. They're creating alternative mechanisms. Many of these organizations anyway were going away from TV to work on voter turnout.
Mm-hmm.
And they're redoubling those efforts, and again, fairly successfully.
Now, are new kinds of political organizations cropping up that would take advantage of opportunities that they might see in this very complicated law?
Some organizations, quasi-party organizations, you can call them, are trying to fill the gaps that parties used to fill to raise and spend soft money in behalf of candidates.
Mm-hmm. Now, are voters seeing any kind of changes yet? When will they notice a difference, if at all? I mean, presuming that the court, until the court decides one way or the other.
For the most part, these laws will not produce changes that voters see. This is about the direct transactions, the direct relationships between office holders and contributors.
Would voters see different kinds of advertising in political campaigns?
They are much less likely to see undisclosed corporate and labor advertising on their televisions. They are much more likely to be getting telephone calls and mail.
So they're going to be reached, but reached through different media?
Yes.
Okay. And by those issue ads is what you're talking about. And those were the kinds of, call Congressman Smith and tell him that his position on the XYZ bill is terrible or something like that.
And Congressman Smith is a rat, but call him and tell him so.
Yeah, okay. Now, there are loopholes in any law, correct?
Yes.
So what are the biggest ones in this one? I mean, it doesn't seem to have restrained the flow of money into the political campaign.
Frankly, I wouldn't call it a loophole. The purpose of this law was not to stop organizations from participating. It was to stop coordinated relationship between office holders and interest groups. They interest groups will continue to participate. The law will not stop groups that are whose members are determined to act. It will stop some of the money from organizations who were giving only because they were being asked.
There was that interesting moment in the tape we heard, and I'm sure you picked it up in the in all the newspapers this morning, where money was described as being extremely inventive. And this was described as sort of a cycle of loopholes are identified and reforms are enacted. The new loopholes come up and more reforms are enacted. Is this a never-ending cycle somehow?
People who want to participate, who have resources, can figure out how to do so. This law was not meant to stop that activity. It was meant to create some space between the people who benefit from the money and the people who act in politics, between the interest groups and the office holders.
What particular, as you listened to these arguments yesterday or read the excerpts today, I mean, what interested you the most?
I thought I was interested, of course, in the Chief Justice. He was always thought to be skeptical. We wondered if he'd be skeptical on issue ads. He has upheld contribution limits in the past. I didn't hear him being as skeptical on the soft money ban as I did on the issue ads.
And right now we're going to talk with a couple of groups who are living through McCain-Feingold to see what's changing for them. Joining us first is Stephen Moore. He's president of the Club for Growth. His organization helps elect candidates who support lower taxes and smaller government. He joins us now from his office here in Washington, D.C. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Neil.
Now, your organization is opposed to McCain-Feingold, particularly the provision that limits advertising. In reality, you say its effect has been positive for you. Explain.
Well, what your listeners need to know about that law, Neil, is that it has so many different components to it. And when the Supreme Court makes its decision about the constitutionality of this law, they could easily strike down some portions of it and uphold others of it. And so the portion of the law that we like is the law, the portion that allows individual donors to give up to $2,000 to a candidate. That's up from $1,000 under the previous set of rules. And that allows candidates to raise money at a faster rate. And I think it also allows candidates who are not self-financing their own races to be more competitive with the multimillion-dollar candidates who are writing their own checks.
Of whom we see more and more in politics.
Yes. My big concern about the direction that we're going in with respect to financing of elections, Neil, is that we see this at the Club for Growth, and as you know, we're involved in dozens of congressional and Senate races every year, that more and more of the candidates who are winning races are the multimillion-dollar candidates who can write a million-dollar check to their own campaign. Because if you're not someone of that level of income, literally you have to spend, I would bet, 75% to 80% of your time as a candidate on the telephone begging for dollars.
Mm-hmm. You believe it's very important to continue to raise the limits on hard money contributions so that they can increase over time. Why? And remind us again how hard money differs from soft money.
Well, a hard dollar contribution is a direct contribution from any individual, like, let's say you, Neil, decides to write a $50 check to a candidate that you like.
50 bucks is about my speed, yeah.
Okay. Well, that would be a hard dollar contribution. It's a direct contribution to the candidate. The candidate can spend that money any way he or she wishes. A soft dollar contribution would be, let's say, a $100 contribution to a group like the Club for Growth or the NRA or Planned Parenthood that would then spend that money running, say, TV or radio ads on behalf of a candidate or an issue. And the real value for candidates is to get those hard dollars so they can spend money to run their campaigns.
Now, when you say you run an ad on behalf of a candidate or an issue, that can be sometimes what we would describe as an attack ad.
Oh, absolutely. For all the talk about how people don't like negative advertising in politics, you wouldn't see people running negative ads if they didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And so, oftentimes the best way to get your point across when you're running a campaign is to point out to voters why the opponent you're running against isn't up to snuff.
Stephen Moore, thanks very much.
Nice talking to you, Neil.
Stephen Moore, president of the Club for Growth. He was with us by phone from his office here in Washington. The American Association of Retired Persons is another group that's taken a position on McCain-Feingold. they're for it. Joining us now is David Certner. He's Director of Federal Affairs for AARP. He's with us by phone from his office here in Washington, and good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
So why does the AARP support this law?
Well, we, of course, supported the original legislation, McCain-Feingold legislation. It really was for one basic point. We're trying to get more of the money and the corrupting influence that money can have out of politics so that members of Congress can focus more on the issues and that individuals, which includes our members, feel that their issues are being heard fairly without the interference of special interest money.
Do you think it's done what it was designed to do?
Well, the bill thus far hasn't had much of a chance to work, and we're sure it's not going to get all the money out of politics. I don't think anyone's naive enough to believe that. And we're probably sure we're going to have to go back and make changes to the law in the future as money finds its way around and into and through the loopholes that will be created by this law. But essentially, this is just another step in what is a long attempt to try to limit the amount of special interest money going into politics.
Is it limiting special interest money?
Well, special interest money will have to find different ways to get there, and we're sure that there'll be clever enough people who will figure out how they will do that. I think time will tell how much of a success we will have with this bill. It hasn't been given much of a chance to work yet, and where there are problems, we'll probably need to go back again and try to see if we can address those as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
David Certner is Director of Federal Affairs for AARP. He joined us by phone from his office here in Washington. Still with us is Michael Malbin. He's Executive Director of the Campaign Finance Institute and author of Life After Reform, which comes out later this week, you said?
Which came out last week.
I apologize for that.
And available from Roman and Littlefield.
Okay, and from a bookstore near you, I'm sure. Is it fair enough to say, as we just heard from David Certner, that the law really hasn't had that much chance to take effect yet?
I think that's absolutely right. It hasn't. Organizations will need to adapt. That's going to take time. And they don't even know what they're adapting to yet. They don't know what the court's going to rule. 1,638 pages of opinions was a lot to digest last May.
Let's go to a caller. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. And joining us is Jerry, who's on the line from Pikesville, Maryland.
Yes, Neil. You know, the founding fathers wanted to guarantee free speech. Anyone can say whatever they want. It's the size of the microphone or megaphone that we're talking about, and Buckley v. Vallejo was wrongly decided. Now, I don't expect the Supreme Court to reverse that precedent, but all of those conservative lawyers who talk about what did the founding fathers intend, no one is restricted from saying anything he wants to say, otherwise protected by the amendment, First Amendment. It's the notion that some people get to magnify what they say a lot more than others, and it's just nonsensical to think that our elections, federal elections, which the Congress has always had a right to regulate, would be inhibited. If it is, it's by people who want a certain result, and that certainly applies to Rehnquist, Scalia, and the group that is likely to favor this. I'd like to hear a comment on that.
Well, all right. Thanks very much for the call. And is this a restriction of free speech? It would seem the argument that we heard was certainly banning ads in the weeks running up to an election is restricting free speech.
Yeah. Is the caller still on the line?
I think he's left.
Okay. At first, I thought he was criticizing Buckley's upholding of contribution limits. At the end, I think he was criticizing the fact that Buckley said you could not limit expenditures. Mm-hmm. I think that's where he was. This is a limitation on speech, as is disclosure, as are a lot of aspects of the law. The test is not whether this limits speech. It's whether there's an adequate justification and whether the harm and the limit is great. Contribution limits have been upheld by the court in Buckley. Limitations on corporate contributions have been upheld for a long time before that. The honest answer is yes, there is some restraint. The question is whether it meets the test of sufficient importance.
We're discussing yesterday's Supreme Court arguments and the McCain-Feingold reform law, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. If this law is to be upheld by the Supreme Court, and again, we have no way other than reading the tea leaves of yesterday's arguments to know which way, one way or the other, but if it's upheld, who would be winners and who would be losers?
The organizations and individuals that can get out small or modest or even $1,000 and $2,000 contributions would be the winners. The losers would be organizations that do not have the kind of support from lots of people and used to write $200,000, $300,000 checks straight from the Treasury.
So can you characterize which kinds of groups those are?
There were some organizations that were little more than front organizations handling corporate money and buying buying TV ads. We won't see those anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The corporations that used to sponsor them will go to grassroots activity, which is on the whole more healthy.
If the law is struck down, at least in large measure, it's this particular law took 7 years for its supporters to get to this point, eventually succeeded only because Senator McConnell, who was one of the principal opponents, thought he had a deadlock cinch to get the Supreme Court to overturn it. That's why he allowed it to pass. The struggle next time is going to be very difficult, isn't it?
If you're asking whether Congress will ever come back to the subject, which is what I think you are.
I think so, in a roundabout way.
I think if this is not upheld and contribution limits won't work, that people who want to look at this problem are going to have to look at stimulating participation rather than using limits, to look at ways of stimulating small contributors, which the Campaign Finance Task Force on Presidential Politics is doing. Our report, by the way, will be released September 22nd. Mm-hmm. It'll be more about empowerment. But that has a different purpose, a different function than the contribution limit, which is about corruption, the appearance of corruption, and office holders twisting the arms of givers.
Mm-hmm. So it's going to have to take a different tack if this avenue is shut off by the court.
It's going to have to take a different tack even if this avenue is supported by the court. Empowerment is a major issue that has not been addressed by this bill.
Mm. And as you say, increasing smaller donations among a larger number of people would be your recommendation for how to combat the perceived difficulties of large money contributions?
Yes. Wealthy people who want to participate will participate and will continue to participate. The problem, another problem to be addressed, and an important one, is how to stimulate people to want to participate in the process who do not now do so.
Well, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here.
Michael Malvin is Executive Director of the Campaign Finance Institute, editor of their recently published book, Life After Reform, When the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act Meets Politics. He joined us here in Studio 3A, and again, thanks for being with us. When we come back from a break, satirist Al Franken, the author of Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, a fair and balanced look at the right. You can join our conversation by calling us at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or send us email totn@npr.org. Back in a moment, I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.